Well, hey, everybody. I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks to a relationship with the God of my experience that I found through sponsorship, working the steps, and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since the 20th day of April, 2010. And for that, I'm grateful. I found a letter. I wrote about 6 months ago, maybe 5 months ago, I wrote a letter to my 10th grade English teacher. She just so happened to be my best friend growing up's mother. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, things weren't going real well. And so I wrote her a letter to express not only my wrong that I had done by treating her class the way I treated it, but also to express my thankfulness, because when I was acting the way I acted in her class, she pulled me out in the hallway, and she asked me what was wrong. And she was the first person to ever pull me aside and actually ask me, you know, what's going on, because this isn't the person that I know. And in looking for a way to describe what I was like, she kind of described it for me in a letter. So she says, Dear Chris, you touched me with your sincerity and impressed me with your recall. That was many years ago. I'd long forgiven and forgotten those sophomore antics of which you have such uncomfortably clear memories. You were pulled out of my class because I knew the real boy underneath the braggadocio. My strongest impression of you from childhood on was of a wonderfully bright but somehow very insecure boy. I worried when you moved out of Wesley's orbit, that's her son, to find faster friends, attributing partly to them to your early angry cynicism. Intelligence poses a danger to kids who perceive the foolishness of the world before they are mature enough to deal with it. Chris, I wish you the best and will think of you often, knowing the difficult struggle you've embraced. If apologizing helps in facing your demons, I'm glad for it. But don't give another thought to any offense you imagine you may have given me. What we did when we were 15 is so minor in the scheme of things, thank God. So that's what I was like. I was very, very insecure. But at the same time, and if you've been around the rooms a little while, you might have heard the term an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I was very sure of the things that I knew and very insecure about the things that I didn't. Mathematically, I was gifted, but socially, I was very awkward. I wanted desperately to fit in with those around me and couldn't, no matter how hard I tried. I knew from an early age that I was different, or at least that's how I felt anyway. And I stress this because what I'm about to say is going to take this in a different direction. There was something in me that was leading me in the direction of alcoholism from the beginning. But I had an instance when I was 11 years old. I went to stay with a friend, and his uncle did some really unsavory things to me. And what that did was solidify my belief that I was very, very, very different from everyone else. No one could understand how I felt or what I had been through. It also solidified my belief that if there was a God in this world, he didn't want to have anything to do with me because he wouldn't let that stuff happen. And from that point forward, I chose not to be confirmed into the church that I was attending, and I chose not to ever pray to God again until much later in my life. And I did so. Arrests, trouble, whatever came, it's what came. I never turned to God for help in those situations. I wasn't one of the people who did the prayers to save me from this situation. God, if you'll get me out of this, you know, I won't do it again. I never did that. I took whatever I got like I took it. I also stopped sleeping real well. I've developed, and I still to this day have a mild case, at the time, severe case of insomnia. I do not like going to sleep, and it started then. I remember staring at the stars and thinking, well, look at all this and how big it is and how wonderful all this stuff is. How could this be without a God, without God? But so hurt by what had happened and by not feeling like anybody was there to protect me that I couldn't. It was too much for me. I didn't want to deal with it. And she talked about in that letter that being aware too soon of how the world really is. And I felt like I kind of got robbed of a little bit of my childhood, and I had to grow up real fast. And I made it a point for the next many years trying to act older than I was. When I was 14, all my friends were in college. By the time I was 18, I was doing things that, or I was attempting in my own mind to do things that I thought people much older than me would do, run restaurants, develop a life, the things that I thought I wanted, you know, the child, the children and the marriage and all these things. I wanted that as fast as possible because I thought that's what life is about. It's about setting these goals, achieving them, and when I get there, everything will be okay. And I kept believing that everything would be okay. At some point, I was going to get to a point in my life where everything was going to be all right. And that point never came. I started drinking at 12, and it doesn't surprise me. I felt very uncomfortable in all the situations I was in. Someone offered me a drink. It gave me a chance to be a part of a group. You know, I kind of fit in with the outcasts, and the outcasts like to drink, and they like to smoke weed. And so that's what I did. I have to say this up front. I am an alcoholic, but I did a lot of drugs. And I'm going to try my best to stick to tradition here and hold it to the alcohol side of things. But if I slip, I apologize. I do not mean to offend any pure alcoholics. It's just part of my story. And from 12 on, I made it a point to drink and or use as often as possible. Now, early on, it wasn't real often. I was 12 years old. It's hard to come across alcohol. It's hard to come across other things. It's just, you know, I got it when I got it, and I did it when I did it. Cigarettes were kind of my go-to. I could smoke them every day. That was my little bit of being bad, you know. Sneak out of class, go smoke some cigarettes out in the woods or in the bathroom or something like that. I got into high school and I started experiencing separation. I don't really know how else to say it. Like, it just, things got worse. It started getting to where I couldn't relate at all, and you know, nobody around me understood, and it just, you know, I got all caught up in poor, pitiful me, you know, and I lived in it. It was a beautiful thing to behold for a little while. By 15, I was very angry, and it showed, and hence the letter. You know, I was acting out in all my classes. I was skipping school. I was getting sent to in-school suspension, and I was still making good grades. I mean, I'm a smart guy. I test well. I just didn't apply myself at all. My junior year in high school was probably my worst, and I say that kind of jokingly. I mean, in all honesty, my experience with it was my worst. It didn't go real well. I got into even more trouble. I spent about 70 or 80 days and suspended from school that year for skipping, for smoking, for cussing out teachers, for doing whatever it was I was doing, you know. And sometime between my junior and senior year, I became very fluent in using and drinking every day. And my senior year was wonderful because I had a solution. I had something that worked for me, you know. When I had that drink, I could mix with the people I was with. I felt comfortable, you know. The promises that it described that we read right before the meeting starts, those were true in my life, you know. I take a drink and all my fears fall away. And I don't worry about stuff anymore. You know, I can mingle and I can handle myself and I'm 10 feet tall, you know. And I used on top of that, and then I got all these other great things going for me. I had found my solution to all my problems. I felt good. I felt whole. I felt complete. And I had enough access and enough money to do it as often as I could. And by that point in time, it was very often. I got expelled my senior year of high school for possession of marijuana on campus. I was very upset at first. Upset that I wasn't going to get, not so much that I got expelled from school. I didn't like school. I didn't want to be in school. School really meant nothing to me whatsoever. But it was that I had grown up with all these kids and these people and my peers. And I had gone from first grade all the way to my senior year in high school with all the same people. And all of a sudden, I wasn't going to get to graduate with them anymore. And that made me really, really, really mad. I went and I took the GED. I didn't pre-test for it. I went and took the GED. And I scored so high on the GED that they named me the valedictorian of the GED class of that year and gave me a two-year full-paid scholarship to college. And basically what it did was it solidified my belief that what I was doing was okay, because I had no consequences related to what had happened. You know, I didn't get arrested. I didn't go to jail. I didn't pay any fines. I got a two-year full-paid scholarship to college, you know. And I didn't use it. I mean, I needed the things I was doing on a daily basis. And it was really hard to go to school and to do well when you're doing the things I was doing every day. I don't want to get up for class because I spent all night drinking the night before. I don't want to go into class because I'm paranoid because I'm so messed up on the substances I'm putting in my body. You know, it was constant, you know. And it was a fight for about a year, and finally I just gave up. I found that I had skills in sales. And so what I did was I applied them to the negative side of life. I became a drug dealer. And I was very good at what I did, and I made a lot of money doing it. My business partner, however, was not very good at what he did, and all the money I made doing it, I spent getting him out of trouble. At some point, I'm sure I pissed somebody off. I did something wrong somewhere along the way, somebody came to me and told me that the DEA was watching me and that I was about to be arrested. So I chose to step away from selling drugs. I made it a noble gesture and said, I don't like the money. It doesn't mean anything to me. But the truth is, I didn't want to go to jail. And so I stopped selling drugs, but I kept using and drinking the way I had been while I was selling them. And the thing is that by that point in time, I was using and drinking in excess. And it cost a lot of money to continue doing the things I was doing. And I no longer had the lifestyle to pay for it. I had my first run-in with treatment in 1999. I had been awake for quite a few days, and I'd been drinking and using a lot. And I had a psychotic episode. I don't really know what else to call it. My brain cracked. That's what I call it, my brain crack. I went from okay to not okay to the point where I could hear people talking that weren't talking and see things going on that weren't going on. And I knew that it was false, but when I could hear it and I could see it, I could feel it inside, like it was just not good. And I went to treatment, and I stayed for 3 days until I couldn't take it anymore, and I went home. And I locked myself in a room for 3 months and raised a cat. I got a kitten and then raised him for 3 months. He's a very crazy cat, by the way. And I really desperately wanted to be able to drink and use like I had been doing before. I never thought maybe I shouldn't do the things that led me to this point. And it talks about it in the book about false, fancied or real, resentments fancied or real, you know, and I can relate because I had a resentment against the last guy that I used with right before I went crazy because I believed that he poisoned me and that's why I went crazy. But if I look back on it from a truthful perspective, you know, I was poisoning myself, you know. And so that was a fancied resentment because I just created it to be okay with what I was doing. And as soon as my mind allowed me, I went back to drinking and using the way I have. I'm a Jack Daniels man. Anytime I had the money and I could afford it and I could drink the way I wanted to drink, I had a fifth of Jack Daniels. That's what I had. That was I never left my side. I'd drink half of it, I'd buy another bottle because that other half's going away sometime soon. You know, and I kept that standard up for a while. The great thing about alcohol is where drugs are unreliable, alcohol is always reliable. If I buy a bag, I don't know if it's any good until I use it. If I buy a bottle, I know it's good when I buy it. If I need to go to sleep because I can't come down off a high, I can drink myself unconscious. You know, if I need to get to feeling better, I can buy a $3 bottle of cheap liquor, and I know it's going to do what I need it to do. I got arrested in 2002 because I wasn't very good at not selling drugs, and I started selling them again to support my habits. And I got arrested in between Auburn and Georgia with a lot of money on me, and I was on my way to pick up drugs. I got charged with felony possession and trafficking, and I went home. Well, I actually thanked the cop for arresting me because I was really tired. Really, really tired. And I made the people in jail really mad because when I got there, I just went to sleep. And I got up and somehow convinced my family to bail me out of jail again because I had been in jail a few times between then and that point in time. Somehow convinced them to drive up to this place and to pick me up. And I went home and I slept it off and I woke up and I started doing what I'd been doing again. And I spent about 30 days in a pretty pitiful state, feeling sorry for myself, using. Thing about me is as I suffer from what the doctor in the doctor's opinion talks about, Dr. Silver talks about, I suffer from that allergy. And I very, very much suffer from the obsession. So 5 days of not using, the thought pops into my head, maybe I should drink and use, it'll make me feel better. I put one in, and then I can't stop because that allergy set off, and all of a sudden I'm running again, you know, drinking and using, drinking and using, drinking and using until something or somebody gets in my way and stops me. My first real experience with a higher power in my life, and I didn't realize it until I got into recovery, was in 2002, I had a set of events happen in my life where I was forced into a situation where I had to ask for help. And it wasn't that I was in danger. It was that I kept having the same thing happen in my life, and it kept saying, you don't want to be like this. You hate the way you are. This is not the person you want to be. And it was just over and over again going on. I went downstairs one morning, and I'd been living in this loft in my family's house for about 30 days, just locked up in there. I'd have people bring me whatever I needed, and I'd just stay there. And I went downstairs, and my father looked me square in the face, and he said, you're drinking and using again, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And for whatever reason, I was willing to be honest in that moment and ask for help. It probably saved me 10 years in prison. I went to a 30-day treatment facility in South Alabama called First Step. It's in Red Level, Alabama. Red Level is so small that the P.O. boxes in Red Level are A through Z. There's no numbers. The treatment center I was in was in a house, and it was right next door to the police department, which was a mobile home. And I don't mean like stationary mobile home. I mean like it was on wheels ready to move when they needed it to move. And it was a good place. I mean, it was half prisoners and half non-insurance people. And I did my 30 days, and I came out knowing that to use was to die. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't take into account that on New Year's Day 1998, I woke up and drank an entire fifth of Bacardi in 15 minutes because it seemed like a good idea. I didn't take into account that I drank at every possible means when I didn't feel well, that I used alcohol to solve my problems. I didn't take into account all that. I just noticed that I'd gotten arrested for this drug charge, and so that drug was my problem. I became a very good alcoholic for the next few years, trying not to go to prison. I got a good lawyer because I didn't have any prior criminal history, or convictions anyway. Georgia has this thing called First Offenders Act. And if it's a nonviolent crime, and I never liked guns, not that I wasn't around them, I just didn't like them, so I didn't carry them on me. Nonviolent crime, and it's your first offense, they give you a very stiff probation. And mine said, you have a two-year intensive probation. If at any point in time you fail during these 2 years to comply with anything that we ask you to do, we'll send you to jail for 10 years, no reduced sentence. And, of course, I didn't want to go to jail at all, so I said yes. I lucked out quite a few times over the next couple years, avoiding DUIs, passing drug tests that I shouldn't have passed, little things that I look back on now and see that I was guided sort of in a direction, you know. Apparently jail wasn't where I was meant to be. I became a daily drinker. I would drink a half a fifth of Jack Daniels and then go to the bar. That was my daily routine. I had a job that paid a lot of money, and I could get away with it. Occasionally, I'd take a day off here or there, and usually what I'd do is I'd substitute some pill or something to get me by until I could get back to having time off so I could drink. And it started showing. It started wearing on me. In 2005, I was on the verge of losing this job because when you go to the bar, when you have to be at work at 10 o'clock at night and you go to the bar at 8, usually 10 o'clock at night doesn't work out real well. And I had been missing work, and I had been slacking on my duties. And this is a job that paid a lot of money. I worked in industry for a while. And I had an x-ray tech job making, you know, near $20 an hour. And I was making good money, and I just couldn't hold it together. No matter how bad I wanted to, I couldn't hold it together. It was getting to the point where I couldn't go an hour or two without drinking and using. I couldn't do it. I couldn't make it that long, you know. So to be at work for 12 hours, I mean, I was sneaking out the back door and drinking out the back on smoke breaks. I was going out to my car and taking breaks and doing stuff in the car. Like, I was, you know, I mean, it was getting bad. And, in 2005, I met a girl. Well, she met me, and she decided that I was the one she wanted. So who was I to argue? And she was like me. She was an alcoholic. She was drinking herself to death. So we were a perfect fit, you know. She was okay with me doing what I wanted to do, and I was okay with her doing what I wanted to do. And And I lost my job. Actually, I got up one night to go to work, and she said, why don't you just stay home tonight? And I knew if I missed one more day of work, I was going to lose my job. So I just stopped going to work. We packed up. We moved to New Orleans to help with the hurricane relief effort after Katrina. Now, I want to explain something. If you're an alcoholic and you're drinking yourself to death, New Orleans is definitely not the place you want to go. I found out real quick that you can buy a $7 gallon of Canadian Mist in New Orleans. $7. You know, they have drive-through daiquiri shops in New Orleans. Drive-through. The only law is they can't put a straw in it for you. So they just set it on top and hand it to you. That didn't last real long. Because I followed me wherever I go. We found out that she was pregnant, and I'd like to say that I chose better actions than I did, but I drank and used with her almost the entire time she was pregnant. We came back to Auburn, lived with my family. I didn't have any money. You know, I drank it all up down in New Orleans. I got a job working at a printing shop making next to nothing, and she stayed home and was pregnant. And we went about our lives like we do. When money got scarce, we found ways to get money, to get what we needed. She introduced me to pain pills, and that worked real good for a little while. But as with everything else in my life that's ever changed or altered my mood or my mind, it stops working. With the type of alcoholic and addict that I am, it stops working fast because I tend to use it up as quick as I can. When my son was born, he was healthy, thank God. I started pulling my stuff back together. I got another good job doing the same thing I was doing for the other company. It was actually, the funny thing was that they were facing each other. So the place I used to work, I now worked at the place facing it. So, making about the same amount of money. I started out a little bit lower, but I quickly work my way up. I'm good at that. I'm good at picking the pieces back together and putting and building my shell back up and making everything look pretty. I'm real good at that. I'm just not good at keeping it together. It always falls apart on me. When my son was 5 months old, about 4.5, 5 months old, he started having seizures. And he had one day, he had 2 the next day, he had 4 the next day, and he had 8 the next day. Until he was eventually having about 80 grand mal seizures a day. And we tried all, they flew him by jet to Children's in Birmingham, and they put him in intensive care, and they were pumping him full of anything they could think of to try to get him to stop seizing, and they just couldn't get it stopped. We got a hotel room near the hospital, and I remember trying to drink my son's sickness away. And I don't know if y'all have ever experienced that before, where something hurts so much you just want to make it go away. You want to make it stop. And I couldn't make it stop. Couldn't make it stop. I couldn't, no matter how much I used or drank, I could not make the thought and the pain go away. I couldn't do it. My son spent about 3 or 4 months in intensive care. We had a priest come to our room, and I told y'all earlier that I'd never prayed to God until later on in my life. And he asked us if we'd like to pray, and I said I would. And I prayed probably the first, and for a while, the only honest prayer I've ever prayed, which is, God, please let my son be okay. And looking back on it now, I would say that my prayer was answered. But what happened was my son got very sick, and he stayed very sick. And when he came out of the situation he was in and got sent home, he was not okay. Not by my standards, anyway. I wanted him to be that 5-month-old perfect kid he was before he started having all his seizures. And that just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen. I don't claim to know anything about the brain. But I know that if you have that many seizures a day for that long, damage can happen. It just can, you know. My drinking and using got just worse. We got her 2 stepkids in to my house, so now I had 3 kids. And I just couldn't stop. I mean, I couldn't do enough, and I couldn't stop. And I wanted things to be different, and I couldn't make them be different, and it was just miserable. I lost that job. I uh, I didn't want to leave Birmingham, but I needed to go back to work, and then I started just lying to try to get out of situations and using my son's illness as an excuse to get money out of people to go and get things that I wanted and needed, you know, just manipulating the way that we do. And I continued. And you do what I was doing. And at the worst points of my drinking and using, when I couldn't get what I needed to be okay, and when I couldn't get out of the house to get alcohol, I would steal my son's seizure medication to get me to a point where I could be okay with being around and be okay, you know. And it's a terrible thing, but it's the truth. It's where I go when I do this stuff. I kind of started to piece my life back together again, put that little shell back on, you know. And I got us into a new apartment, and my wife came home, and she said, "I can't be with you anymore." And then she brought a guy home with her to say that she'd been seeing somebody else. And that was pretty much the last reason I needed to try to act normal and to be okay anymore. I was done. I didn't want to, you know, I had no more, I didn't need to put my life back together to take care of my kid. I didn't want to fix anything. And I went into a three-week blackout. And as in these other instances in my life, I had a moment of clarity. I got a phone call. A guy had approached me about programming and doing aluminum work for another company. And I turned it down to stay with the grocery chain that I was with. I was the assistant department manager for Kroger. And in the middle of this three-week blackout, I got a phone call. And apparently the guy that they had chosen to take the place that I was going to take had fallied somehow or fallen out of the position, and they were desperately seeking help. And I'm in the middle of broke, verge of homelessness, like things were not going real well. And I managed to get this call, and it was like a hand reaching out and pulling me out of the depths, you know. You know, it was not to be. I went and got the job, and I passed the drug test miraculously, and, you know, got on to working and moved up, and I'm an isolationist when I'm drinking and using. In the end, it was all about me being by myself, doing what I wanted to do, and don't get in my way. And so all of a sudden, I'm making a lot of money again, and I'm living in a new city, and there's no one within miles of me that I know. And what it turned into was literally me drinking myself to sleep every night, waking up 2 hours later, drinking to go back to sleep, 2 hours later, drinking to go back to sleep, and then get up and go to work the next day. And it got real bad because I started having to use and drink at work like I had started to have to do with that other job. And, you know, I made an ill-fated trip to Atlanta to visit a friend of mine, and I tried something that I hadn't tried in a while, and that allergy was set off, and all of a sudden, 3 days later, I turned my phone on, and Atlanta Metro Homicide's looking for me. And all these, everything's crumbling back down again, you know. Because when I black out, I do crazy stuff. I lost my job, and I had to come back and live with my family. And I just gave up on life. I spent 3 months, two of which homeless, doing what I had to do to get by. And at some point, my family got so sick of watching me kill myself that they kicked me out, you know, told me not to come back. I couldn't stop stealing from them. And they came to me and they offered me one last chance. And they said, and again, moment of clarity in the middle of a blackout, we'll renew your insurance and send you to treatment. And what they said is, we'll send you to a detox. We'll send you to a 3 to 5 day detox, and then you come back home. And for whatever reason, and I'd only been to Bradford once, for whatever reason, I said, if you send me somewhere to detox and I come back home, I'm going to end up doing exactly what I've been doing. I need to go somewhere longer. They got me into treatment. I blacked back out, and when I came to, I was in treatment. I literally woke up on the 27th day of June 2009 in a bed in Bradford with clothes next to me that I'd never seen before, and I felt kind of peaceful, to be honest with you, because I woke up that morning and I didn't have to go back. I didn't have to run anymore, you know. I had gotten to a point in my life where it just, every day I woke up, I was hoping I could drink and use myself to death that day. And then I'd wake up again, and I'd have to do it all over again. And it was like that for a while. And the book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I did things for drugs and alcohol that I just never thought that I'd do. You know, I never thought that I would go to the depths that I went to. And you know, it is what it is. So what do I do with it from there? I spent the 15 days in treatment, had a kind of a God moment, sent me to a halfway house. I did 82 days, and I did what a lot of people in AA call the AA waltz. I accepted I'm alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. I think I believe that there's a higher power out there. I will tentatively turn my will and my life over to that higher power. I will work half the 4-step, and I'll get drunk. And I got a hotel room at 82 days clean and sober, and I got a girl I really was interested in, and I had her at the hotel room, and then I went out and got drunk. And which is funny, because I didn't have anywhere to go. You know, I had to go back to the halfway house. You know, now I've got the allergy on me, and I want to do more and more and more, and I put myself right back in that same boat. I actually called a friend hoping that they could hook me up with some way to keep going, and they pointed me back to the halfway house. So, wound up back in the halfway house and started over again. You know, I hate to say the things that I say that are involved with my life because I feel like it's a big tragedy story, but I'm going to tell you something, and it's the biggest God moment I've ever experienced in my life. On October the 12th of 2009, I was 14, 15 days sober off this relapse, and my parents show up at the halfway house, and I'm a little confused. One, they're not supposed to show up, and two, they were supposed to show up a few days before that. And they come up, and I have a little brother, my little brother is very much like me. Always wanted to be like me. In the end, we started running and gunning together. What he did to solve his problems was he'd go overseas. He joined the Army. So what happened is every time he'd get arrested or get a felony DUI, he'd enlist again or re-enlist to go back over there again. He did 3 tours overseas, 2 of which he did in Afghanistan and Iraq, and 1 of which he did in Germany and Kuwait. And my parents show up at the halfway house. And you know, there's some moments you just go into and you look up and you just know something's not okay. I knew it wasn't okay. I got real nervous, like the butterflies inside, and I wanted to keep talking real fast. And I wanted, you know, I just didn't want them to talk because I knew as soon as they talked, something bad was coming out. And what they told me was that my brother had gone to sleep and he had not woken up. And, you know, that confused me. It confused me because my brother didn't go to the depths that I went to, you know. My brother didn't do a lot of the things that I did. Now, he did a lot. Don't get me wrong. He just didn't do a lot of things I did. And you know, who's ever ready for that, you know? No one's ever ready for that. And especially me at 14 days and crazy. I wasn't ready for it. So my parents, the trick of it was, though, is that they drove up there. They drove all the way from Auburn to Birmingham to tell me this because they were afraid I would go out and do the same thing when I found out. So they drove to Birmingham after finding their son dead to tell their other son what had happened because they didn't want to find him dead too. And that kind of breaks all those boundaries about us not affecting other people with our actions. It kind of breaks down that barrier that we have that says, I'm just hurting myself. Because here are two people who, their second child, they just let the coroner take them away. And they're going to drive 2 hours to make sure that their other son doesn't do the same thing. And I felt very small. And I let them leave, and I went into my apartment in the halfway house, and I hit my knees, and for the second time in my life, I prayed an honest prayer. And the prayer was simply, help me, God, I don't know what you want me to do with this. And he did. I went home 2 days later. I wrote the eulogy for my brother's funeral, which I keep in my big book. I got to experience that time with my family. I got to be there for my mom and for my dad, for my little sister. I got to see the people that I had run with who were friends of his also, who came to the funeral, and I got to do it sober. And that was big for me. I think that in all honesty, experience-wise, that's the most powerful experience I've had in recovery so far is that moment, because here I am, I can't stop drinking and using. And if you're going to use over something, what's better to use over than someone in your family dying, right? Some big tragedy happened in your life. Or at least that's how I would have taken it before. And yet, by simply asking for help, I was able to get through the situation, and not only get through it, but be useful to the people around me. That's a big deal for me. I would love to tell you that that was enough to keep me sober, and it wasn't. I did a very thorough four-step. I had a good sponsor. I had the sponsor I needed at the time, a sponsor that was going to lead me to that relationship I needed with a higher power to help me feel okay. Because when I don't drink and use, I feel worse than I do in the end when I was drinking and using. I get restless, irritable, discontent. Life starts getting too hard. My emotions get on me. And all of a sudden, drinking seems like a good idea again. Out of nowhere. And the most insane act I will ever commit is taking a drink. Because I'm sober when I do it. And I know what's going to happen when I do it. I worked a thorough four-step, fifth-step. I did 6 and 7 fairly well. Who's to say how well you do 6 and 7? I don't really know. I don't think I figured that one out yet. I made a great list, and I began making my amends, and I got about 5 or 6 of them in, and I just stopped. You know, I'd gotten some of the promises coming true in my life, and I got feeling good again, and that was enough, or so I thought. And the time came when life became too hard, and because you had a girlfriend and I didn't, or because you had the job and I didn't, or because you had the money and I didn't, and I started judging myself by where y'all are at, and it's a terrible place to be, because I can never judge myself by where anybody else is at but me. And it got really bad, and I started desperately seeking ways to feel better, and I did that through the female feces, and I went to female after female after female until I found one that would have me. And the one that would have me just happened to be really sick. And me being restless, irritable, and discontent, and her being really sick, back in it again. I thought I could do it just once. This is what my thought process was. I thought I could just take one, and I wouldn't have to tell anybody. You know, I had a sponsor I was working with, you know, had like, you know, about 7, coming up on 7 months sober, you know. And I thought I could just take one, and I'll just jump back in the next day, and it'll be okay. Well, I forget that when I start, I can't stop. And then once I put it in, that obsession is so strong. It's just that drive and that compulsion to use and drink is so strong. I somehow managed to ask for help. Got sent back to treatment. They allowed me to come back for free for 7 days. Apparently there's some clause in my insurance that allowed that to happen. I got out and I went right back to that girl because it was my birthday. I woke up in treatment on my 30th birthday. And that was the last day there. And that was April 18th, 2010. Woke up in treatment. And I got out and the only thing I could think about was going and meeting that girl so I could get me some, you know. And I did. I met her and I got me some, and the next day I got drunk again. And somewhere in there I broke because I've been trying to force my will on every situation. I had to have what I wanted. I had to do it my way. I had to have things the way I wanted to have them. And what had happened was is that I had basically accepted that alcohol and me weren't going to work together. But I hadn't accepted that my life was unmanageable. Even though I had come from homeless and come from halfway house and done all the, you know, been all these places, I hadn't accepted that I wasn't doing a good job of handling things. And something broke. I drove myself down to Auburn to a treatment facility down there. I spent about I spent about 10 days in there before I went completely insane. I was so angry. Just so angry that I had lost this contact that I'd had, that I had So I wanted to blame myself for drinking and using, you know, which it was my fault. But the truth is that I'm an alcoholic, and if I don't do the things that are asked of me, that's what I do. I drink. If I don't work the steps, if I don't pray and meditate, if I don't go to meetings, if I don't read my big book, if I don't do these simple things on a daily basis, I drink. That's where I'm going to go. That is an accepted fact for me today, is that I will drink again. Unless. And so I got really angry and I went home and I kept swearing I wasn't going to pray. But the thing is, just by swearing I wasn't going to pray, I was accepting the fact there's a higher power out there. I was just angry. And I gathered my things together and I went back to Birmingham and I dove into the steps with my sponsor. And I mean dove in head first. I mean hardcore dove in. I think, and this is important for me to say, that it is very important for me to be able to relate to what's in this book, to identify. And something I hadn't done before was read the first four chapters, including the doctor's opinion, and look at how I identified with it. Not looking at the fact that I'm not a New York stockbroker, and it's not 1939, and it's, you know, I'm not an old white man, and who knows about this, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. None of that stuff. It's important that I identify with it, because if I can't identify with what's in the book, how am I going to receive the solution that comes as a result of what they're telling me? So I identified with the book. I accepted wholeheartedly the first step, which I think is what it means to surrender. If I accept that I'm doomed, that I can either go on drinking and blot out, you know, my intolerable existence to the best of my ability, or accept spiritual help. Those are my two options. You know, that's how it is for me today. And I accepted the first step. And that made it real easy to accept the second step. Because if I'm doomed, my God, there better be something out there that can help me. And I had already experienced twinges of it, so it was easier for me to approach. The third step was the part that I guess I kind of fumbled a lot, you know. It's only a decision, but it's a decision I can always take back. Just because I decide and get down on my knees and pray in the third step with my sponsors that God can have me and He can lead me and He can guide me and He can work through me to show everybody else what He's capable of, I can always stop doing those things because it's only a decision. And my sponsor had me write my own third-step prayer. It talks about it in the book. You know, the wording was quite optional. And it helped me develop a relationship with this guy. And I did a thorough four-step, and I did it real. I looked at the third and the fourth column a lot more than I had before. Before, it was about me just getting off the stuff that I had done wrong and all the terrible things that had happened in my life and how I was a terrible person and all this self-pity and self-loathing and blah, 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 self. And this time I looked at why I had the resentments and what parts of me were affected by it. You know, why is it that I react the way I do in situations when people say things to me, when people do these things? Why is it that I react that way? How do I react as a result of things that happened to me in my life that maybe weren't my fault? I took that, what happened to me when I was 11, and I ran with it as long as I possibly could and used it as an excuse to do the things I did. You know, well, you would do it too. If this happened to you, I have a right to drink. I don't have that luxury anymore. I don't have the right to be angry. I don't have the right to drink, you know. And I really looked at the third and fourth column of that inventory, you know. What was my part? How is it that I'm acting that's not okay, you know? Because what I try to do on a daily basis is be the best man that I can be. Now, I fall short a lot. I do. It happens. But I try. And then when I make a mistake, I get back up and I try again. I want to tell you a couple of stories about recovery and about what you guys have done for me. When I walked into the rooms to my first meeting outside of treatment, completely off all substances, I walked into a room and I sat down and I was shaking. And I shook pretty heavily throughout the whole meeting. And I shook so bad that the two girls sitting next to me got up and left the meeting. And when the meeting was over, and I don't know what the topic was, I know I spoke. I don't know why I spoke or what I said. I was really scared, and I was really afraid that I was never going to be okay with who I was. I know that. And I got up and I went to go pick up my newcomer chip, my 24-hour chip, my, you know, surrender chip, start or restart this way of life chip, whatever you want to call it. And the guy, big burly biker, not real tall, but big and burly, was handing out chips that night. And when I walked up, I guess what I had said had struck a chord with him. Because he gave me a big old hug and he said, "It's okay, we'll love you until you can love yourself." And from that point forward, I knew I belonged in these rooms. I didn't identify with all of you at first, but I knew that somebody in here understood maybe just a twinkling of how I felt. And that's the hope that I needed to stay here. I made a very thorough 8-step list. And amends are probably, and in my opinion, amends are the coolest part of this program. They are where I get the most results. Through action and through daily repetition, I get a lot of results from this program, but from making these amends, I get free, completely and totally free. One of my last jobs I had, I had borrowed $100 from my boss to do what I do with $100. And then I quit the job. Well, not that this is the biggest amends, but I was really worried about going back to see him, and I made sure I had my $100 on me, and, you know, I was ready, and I called in advance, make sure I made an appointment so he was good to go, you know, set everything up, talk to my sponsor, and, you know, have my little, I have note cards for all my amends. I make them out, and then I organize them based on if I know where they're at, if I know the phone number, if I know the address, if I know where they're located, so on and so forth. And I have them in my car, and I keep a couple of them in my dashboard, so I'm always reminded that if I got more to go, that I need to keep moving forward. Because I told y'all, I stopped in the middle of my minutes last time. What happened? I got drunk. So I go to meet this guy, and I get it set up, and I'm walking around the store, and I'm really nervous because I'm afraid to see all the people that I used to work with. Because I walked out on them, too, you know. I mean, I just, you know, just, boom, didn't show up for work anymore. And I, like I said, I'd been the assistant department manager, so it wasn't like I'd, you know, just random, you know. I went back in to make amends to him, and I sat down and I gave my pitch, but with heart, which is what I do in any amends. I have the basic thing that I say, like I'm working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no hope of staying sober unless I can right these wrongs in my life, and then I'd be on. Then I'm honest with them on a person-to-person basis, which is when I did this to you, it was wrong. It was dishonest, selfish, inconsiderate, fearful, you know, and I want to know what I can do to make it right. I never say I'm sorry, because I've said I'm sorry plenty. It's what can I do to right the wrong. And he sat down, and he said, and I started to hand him $100. He said, "Stop." And he set me back down in my seat. And he said, "Look," he said, "I want you to know that you coming in here and doing this means a lot to me. And that I'm just happy to see you in the state that you're in now versus the state you were in when you left." He said, "I don't want your money." He actually offered me a job. Now, I didn't take the job. I was living in another city. But it was amazing to me that this person, because I had always looked at the world as all the negatives in everybody else, you know. I'd always seen myself in everyone, you know, out for myself. Get what you can get. Ain't nobody really nice. They're just putting on a show. You know, that's what I believed. This man showed me that there were people in the world who really did care. He goes, "Look, your name is on a plaque downstairs as winning some employee of the quarter or something like that." He said, "You know, you were good. You just, these things happened, you know." And he thanked me for my time, and he thanked me for coming in. He said, "If I never see you again, I'm happy to know that this was the last time I saw you." That was a big deal to me. I robbed my grandmother blind, and I'm to this day paying for it. I make a portion of my paycheck, and I give it to her every week. It's the only financial amend that my family has asked me to pay, and it's a large sum of money. They said, "We don't want the rest of your money, but we want you to pay your grandmother back," and I will. I'll pay it back until I'm done. Another random amends story I'll make is, while I was in New Orleans, I lived with a guy, and I borrowed a bunch of money from him to pay my rent, and then dipped out, never came back. So this gentleman, I didn't know how to find him. It had been 5 years, you know, all these things. And the weird thing about this program is that when I'm ready and I'm willing to make these amends, it seems like they just sort of surface and find me. It's not so much about me finding them as it is they just come to me. And through random occurrence, I was able to find this gentleman. And I sent him his money, and he did the same thing the other guy did. He thanked me for paying him the money that I owed him, you know. And he said, you know, he said some really nice things. And he said, I didn't think you'd ever pay me back. He said, you were scot-free. Why'd you send me the money? You know, where, how was I going to find you, you know? Or how was I going to prove that you owed it to me? I want to express something because it's important. It's important for me to express to you that I am not the person I just told you about. I am not the guy who did all those things before I worked these steps. I'm completely changed. I think the most important thing I've done in recovery is reestablish, aside from the relationship I've established with a God that I experience today. It may not be the God that you experience, but it's, you know, the one that keeps me sober, is reestablishing that relationship with my little boy. Now, he is disabled as a result of the seizures, but he's the happiest kid you'll ever meet. And as a result of working this program, I get to spend time with my kid today and spend time where I'm just focusing on him and not thinking about everything else. I get to experience peace today. I didn't know it was possible. I have moments in time where my head doesn't talk to me. I get to experience a lot of stuff today that's pretty cool. When I started really practicing step 10, which is, I like to call it my walking around step, when something comes up that troubles me, when something arises that's troubling in my life, I stop, I step back, you know, I check my, you know, what's disturbing me, what part of self is affected, you know. Do I owe someone an amends? And believe me, I've made a lot of amends on the spot to people that I've said harsh things to and or done harsh things to. Step 11 is where I'm still working. Meditation is a strange art. It's different for everybody. What I have found is that what I'm really trying to achieve in my own meditation is that I'm trying to hear what God has to say. Because if I'm doing nothing but talking to God, I never listen for the answers that he's given me. So meditation and prayer for me are praying. I'm asking God for his will to be done in my life, for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. And in meditation, I'm listening for him to tell me what his will is. And sometimes I hear things that I think are his will, and like the book says, I'm foolishly thinking that, and I make a lot of mistakes. But a lot of times I get inspiration in times when I really need it. And I get to end up places that I need to end up and do things that I need to do. And it's led me a lot of cool places. I have a job today that I love. I never thought that'd be possible. I'm satisfied with it. I'm a good employee. I'm a good father. I'm starting to be a good son to my family. It's getting better. And then the coolest part of this whole experience for me is that now, being saved from that life that I told you about, being saved from that hopelessness and that desperation, I get to go and try to help somebody else come out of the same thing. I know a lot of people who come into here, and me and Jim were talking about it before the meeting, who come in and they get better and they go back out and they disappear. You know, I've got my life back, I'm going to go back to doing what I'm doing. And what the book tells us is that nothing so much ensures immunity from alcohol as intensive work with other alcoholics. And what it also goes on to say later is that nothing will be a brighter spot in your life. You know, by working with guys that I work with, I get to see what it's like to be back at the beginning because I forget. And I get to help somebody else climb out of the gutter and experience this wonderful thing that I've experienced. You know, I can't explain the change. I can't explain it. I can feel it. I know that there is happiness and satisfaction I have in my life today that I've never experienced before, ever. And to not want to give that to somebody else, I don't understand. I get to come in here and use my brother's story, my experiences, all these negatives that have happened in my life, and use them as positives. I get to use my brother's story as a force to help somebody else avoid the same situation. I get to use my downfall as a force to let someone else know that they don't have to go through the same thing. or if they have gone through it, to know that somebody else has gone through it too. It was important to me when I came in here to be able to relate to other people and to know that somebody else felt the way I felt. And today, my purpose is laid out in the 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. That's my purpose today. My purpose is to carry this message and to carry what I'm learning in here and the experiences I have out into the world with me. It's my purpose. I never had a purpose before. I have a purpose now. So, hopefully, I'll continue to do this, and I'll continue to accept when people ask me to take part in my recovery, and I'll continue to give when people need it to be given, and I'll continue to care when no one else is caring. And thanks for letting me share my story with you.